KZSU FM Stanford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I am an assistant professor of law at the Charlotte School of Law in Charlotte, North Carolina, as well as a non-resident fellow at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School. Thank you for joining me today on Hearsay Culture. Today I'm excited to continue discussion focusing particularly on the practical side of intellectual property law. We spend a lot of time discussing the impact of IP from a theoretical perspective, as well as from perspective involving certain industries, involving technology. What is patent law doing, or what is IP law doing? We focus on patent law recently, and we've had on a few guests of the show. Most recently, former dean and now professor at Hamline University School of Law, John Garin, who wrote a book called Own It, focusing on how companies can marshal intellectual property law. And we have a guest on whose book is in a similar vein, although far from identical and with different kinds of focuses. The author is Michael Gollan, partner in the Washington, D.C. office of Venable LLP. And his book is Driving Innovation, Intellectual Property Strategies for a Dynamic World, published by Cambridge University Press. Driving Innovation is, I think, a wonderful handbook to get a comprehensive grasp of how intellectual property law works in the modern business, quote unquote. And while many books focus particularly on the law, what I like about Michael's book and what we're going to be focusing on primarily today are the human factors of managing intellectual property in businesses, focusing primarily in the United States, although not exclusively. And in the book, Michael takes an approach which focuses on this human factor and focuses particularly on how companies can go about using intellectual property to their advantage. And when we talk about intellectual property, and we often do this on Hearsay Culture, we discuss one or maybe two areas of intellectual property, and the four obviously being patent, copyright, trademark, and trade secret. Well, Michael's book is very comprehensive and discusses the interplay of these four areas of law quite nicely and I think quite usefully for anyone who wants to think about these issues from a practical perspective, but also for businesses that that need ultimately to have a general understanding of IP law. I might suggest that the book is almost in the form of a desk book that I think lawyers that deal with IP issues on the corporate side would want to have a handle on. But I also think it's quite valuable to people that are thinking about where intellectual property law is headed, because in Michael's book, Driving Innovation, Intellectual Property Strategies for a Dynamic World, we get this perspective of a very seasoned and experienced counsel to businesses in the United States. Michael is, by way of brief background, a registered patent attorney. He prosecutes patents and trademarks, negotiates IP agreements, and litigates all forms of IP cases. He has two decades of experience providing strategic counseling to clients in all aspects of IP law and related areas of technology transfer, food, drug, and cosmetics law, and environmental law. His resume, which can be found at his firm's website, venable.com, lists quite an impressive resume and background focusing on different aspects of how one would go about managing IP, and he has extensive experience counseling businesses on the management of IP. In addition to Driving Innovation, he co-authored the books Innovations in Groundwater and Soil Cleanup from Concept to Commercialization in 1997 and Biodiversity Prospecting in 1993. He's also a prolific author has been interviewed by NPR, Bloomberg, Fox News Channel, Time Magazine, and several newspapers. So with that introduction, I want to thank you, Michael, for joining me today on Hearsay Culture.
Thank you, David. It's a pleasure to join you and your listeners.
Terrific. Well, let's start right off with a standard question that I ask really every author that I have on the show. So I've given a bit of your background, but perhaps you could start, and perhaps in more detail, talk about that background and how you came to focus on these issues.
Well, I could go back pretty far, all the way to high school and an interest in science and just why are plants green and that kind of thing, and that led me through graduate school in biochemistry and molecular biology. But I found I was more interested, like you, in the intersections of science and society, and that led me to go to law school. And in law school, I was interested in environmental law and intellectual property law. I came out of that into a very different world of intellectual property than we have today. In fact, it wasn't even called that. It was called patent, copyright, trademark, and trade secret law. And over the years, since the early 80s, I, with my interest in the social impacts of technology and intellectual property, I got involved more in issues of environmental technology and conservation, and then further into these issues of globalization. And I started representing not just corporations but nonprofit organizations, research institutions in places like Kenya and Nigeria and India, and that opened my eyes to the importance of intellectual property around the world in for-profit and non-profit organizations, and just really the fascinating depth of this field. I started teaching in 2000, teaching MBA students at Georgetown, and from the experience in counseling clients for 20 years and then teaching smart MBA students for half a dozen, I wanted to put together a book to synthesize all these lessons and to try to communicate some of the both the practical points, as you say, and the dynamics of how this is a really constantly changing field to a broader audience.
Which kind of gets to a follow-up question as an intro. Who is your target audience?
Well, you could say there are three. One is the general reader, somebody who is interested in economic and cultural literacy, somebody who wants to understand the invisible infrastructure of innovation. How do trademarks and patents and copyrights lead to the existence of this radio show being broadcast across the airwaves or downloaded through a computer? How do they come together and put an author with a publisher with ink on paper and produce a book that's distributed around the world? And I think most people have some inkling that intellectual property is important in that, but they don't really understand why, and they may not realize that intellectual property, it goes back thousands of years in one way or another and really isn't a driving force for human society. Another group is, as you say, the practitioner, somebody involved in the creative work, whether an artist or a scientist or an engineer or somebody who works with them in a company that that produces new products or services. And so it includes business people as well, of course, as lawyers.
It's a pretty broad audience, and often when you're especially given your experience in the law in particular, it's often difficult to translate what might be an in-depth legal analysis to a broader audience. So I'm curious, as you crafted this book, how did you or what attempts did you make to bring the depth of legal analysis that I think you did in the book to the broader audience, in the sense that you're not going to have lawyers necessarily reading this book?
Right. So the one of the challenges I faced in writing the book was to try and pare down a lot of the legal arcane details to get at what I call the fundamental concepts and practical strategies that that make intellectual property work. And to do that, I asked some questions like, is this important for patents as well as trade secrets and copyrights and trademarks? What are the common features to all these very different fields of law and endeavor? Is this something which is important not only in a multinational corporation but also a small startup? And also, is this a driving force that applies to an individual artist? Is it something that applies to nonprofit research organizations like Stanford University or the National Institutes of Health or a similar research institution in a developing country? So my test was, if this is something which seems to hold true in several of those settings, then that's my definition of fundamental.
What, taking your background for a moment before we get into focusing on some of the substance of your book. And, of course, even in an hour interview, we can only touch the tip of the iceberg. But I'm curious, given your experience counseling clients, both counseling and litigating an IP over at least 20 years, perhaps you could describe what your practice in terms of the kinds of issues you were dealing with and the scope of your practice 20 years ago versus now. Now, putting aside the fact that you have a growing practice, what did IP law practice look like when you entered the legal profession?
Well, it was very insulated, and most people didn't really know what you were doing as a patent attorney. You would tend to work in a very isolated practice. In fact, most of the law firms that were practicing at that time in the 80s were specialty law firms. And I recall that when I was a young associate, one of the named senior partners was in the library one day, and I asked him what he was doing there. Didn't he know the law? And he joked that he was just checking to see if any of it had been changed. And the law was pretty static in the 80s. It was sort of received as the proper way, sort of the natural law. This is patents and trademarks and copyright are fairly stable, and the impression was almost that this was that it had always been this way and always would. But that's changed quite a bit, and I'd say in the 90s, through globalization, the international negotiation of the World Trade Organization, provisions on intellectual property, the involvement of a lot more political groups, have made intellectual property much more fast-changing and much more broader-reaching, and the practice has become much more interesting.
I certainly know for me, entering IP practice was something I was interested in, but it was a matter largely of serendipity in that I moved to Prior Cashman in New York during the dot-com boom, literally a situation where associates, as I'm sure you can recall, were leaving law firms to make their millions in startups, and suddenly there was a need for mid-level and junior associates at firms that generally were not looking for as many people as they might have been in a given year. So I got lucky. And I'm curious because a number of people listening to this show not only are law students, but people that are interested in getting into the IP field, that perhaps before we get into the substance of the book and focusing on this human dimension that is a large focus of your book, perhaps if you have any advice or anything you might suggest, given the current state of the economy, and of course we're recording the show on October 28th, it'll be aired on October 29th, what suggestions do you have for people that want to enter the IP law field?
Well, it's a really great question, and we're speaking, of course, to from a pre-election time frame to a post-election audience.
That's right.
I think.
Well, actually, no. The show will air tomorrow on the 29th. So, just about.
I think that intellectual property is a noble profession. I think that it's really crucial to have intellectual property done right to promote innovation, and I think innovation is the key to working our way out of the mess that the country's in. I sincerely believe that. And every day that I practice, I become more passionate about the field. I think it's a terrific area. And my advice would be, make sure that you understand the creative process. Make sure that if you're going to work with science or technology, make sure you understand the science and technology very well. If you're going to work with artists or people on the creative side, make sure you understand that process and the industry as well. And make sure that you are ready to learn quickly because this field is changing all the time. And one needs to be a quick study to keep up with it. And that's really a lot of what I try to convey in the book, so that somebody who reads the book or much of it, or the parts that are particularly interesting to them, will have a strong foundation for understanding the basic driving forces in innovation and intellectual property and be able to then work with them in any given situation. And we've proved that in the course that I teach to the MBAs who come into the process not knowing a copyright from a trademark, and they come out at the end of the course writing really smart analyses of companies or organizations and with very sound advice, perhaps better than their bosses might be able to give.
And that certainly would be a good outcome for the, especially for the entry level associate. Let's get into some of the substance of your book, and talk about this first from, the perspective, the broad perspective of IP and innovation. I mean, we know, and certainly listeners of this show, anyone that's listened regularly knows that, that the core of United States IP law generally is this utilitarian theory of, giving economic rewards for innovation. And especially on Hearsay Culture, we've had a number of guests on recently who take a very dim view of intellectual property law. Their view, and literally a few weeks ago, we had David K. Levine, no relation, Emma Kelly Boldrin from Washington University in St. Louis on talking about their book Against Intellectual Monopoly. We've had on Mike Moyer from Boston University discussing patent failure. Josh Lerner from Harvard Business School discussing his book from last year, also criticizing the patent system. We see a lot of criticism of the patent system in particular, although obviously the copyright system has its focus. But as a patent, as someone that focuses heavily in patent law, perhaps to start our conversations off substantially, I'll ask for your view of the job that IP law is doing, and we can start by focusing on patent law. What's your view? I mean, is patent law today as broken as many people suggest?
Well, the answer is yes and no. I think it's broken in a number of practical ways that are relatively straightforward to fix. And unfortunately, there's a lack of, I don't want to say will, but there's a lack of a way to really make those relatively simple fixes. I think more fundamentally, the answer is no. I think the patent system is inevitable and crucial. And I think it really overstates the case to talk about total failure, and I think that people who look to eliminating the patent system in the extreme are really just not living in the same world that I am, and I can explain it in the word inevitable. I think that if you go back thousands of years, people have been creative since humankind first evolved. And so you ask, what do people do with the output of their creative work, of their new ideas and the work with their hands and so on? And you can look back thousands of years and see essentially a trade secret notion that people would keep their secrets in their guilds in the Middle Ages or before that. I have in my book an Egyptian hieroglyphic tablet by the artisan, the chief scribe of a pharaoh in Egypt, who says all these wonderful things he knows about papyrus and ink and dancing and how to strike a prisoner so they'll talk, and that he'll keep all these things secret except with the permission of his divine sovereign. And that just drives home the notion that the sort of the baseline is trade secrecy. And the patent system developed 500 years ago in Venice, and if you look at the Venetian patent law, it's remarkably similar to the laws we have today. And it really only differs in some subtle variations. The principle of disclosure as the alternative to trade secrets is there. The notion that the state, in that case Venice, in our case the nation, will enforce the rights of the innovator, and that's to be an incentive for people to both to locate there and innovate and disclose their inventions. And I think if you were to eliminate or devalue patents too far, it's like a balloon. You push on one side and the creativity will pop out somewhere else and trade secrets. And I think that's a problem. I think that moreover, when you look at what's really fundamental about intellectual property rights, whether it's patents or trade secrets, copyrights or trademarks, what's really happening is a struggle over exclusivity or access. Mm-hmm. And I can put it simply this way. If I invent something, I want to control the dissemination of that invention. I want to limit your access to my invention. But at the same time, I want full access to your inventions.
Right.
And anybody can see that there's a tension there. The two are irreconcilable as absolutes. And so the only way to reconcile my desire to control my invention and have access to yours is by balancing that access and that exclusivity somewhere in between. And that's exactly what the patent system is intended to do, by limited rights that go for a certain period of time that cover only new inventions. And you can make the same analysis for each of the other types of intellectual property, but we'll stick with patents for a moment. So that balancing point inevitably is in tension and will shift from place to place over time, as it has for the past 500 plus years. And as I predict, it will continue to shift for the rest of the next 500 years. And so, to me, the critique of the patent system is a healthy thing. It's a good thing. The system constantly needs to be readjusted, and so that it serves the needs of the society at the time. So I think that it's like walking around in the forest and saying this particular tree is diseased, or we want to cut this tree down, but missing the larger forest.
The book is Driving Innovation. The author, Michael Gollan, partner at Venable, Washington, D.C. office. Michael, when you look at these issues, and we're going to touch, and we're going to really discuss the human factors here in a moment, but when we discuss these issues, especially when you see and see academics discussing these issues, of course the reality is that your clients are not spending, I would imagine, that much time sitting back and thinking about the theoretical underpinnings of IP law. While not irrelevant to their business, they have more pressing needs that they have to focus on. And I'm curious, from your perspective, counseling entities who are applying IP law, what do you think their view is in terms of IP doing its job? Now, obviously, that's a broad question, because for certain industries it seems to work well better than others. But again, focusing on patent law in particular, what's your sense in terms of the business broadly, the business world's reaction to or conception of this very heated debate occurring in scholarly circles regarding the failures, at least arguable failures, of patent law?
Well, it is a huge issue for clients, and it affects what how I advise them and what they do every day. And I think there is there are echoes from the practitioners to the academics and backwards again. A few points. One, the problems in the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office are enormously frustrating to anybody pursuing patent protection right now. There's a crushing backlog, and the Patent and Trademark Office has gone, in my view, in the wrong direction by stifling the passage of patents out of the office and issuance. Rather than improving the examination, they've essentially throttled back, almost cutting in half, the allowance rate of patents in many of the areas. Now, so in the life sciences, where patents are really the lifeblood of a new company and become crucial in larger companies as well, that's a huge problem, and again leads companies to look to protecting things with trade secrets or simply to narrow their research efforts. It also undercuts the collaboration between universities, who are patenting early stage research by their faculty and trying to use those patents as tools for investment by companies who want to invest the huge amounts of money necessary to develop an early stage invention. Without patents, those early stage inventions may just be of interest for science, but not they become the system that under the Bayh-Dole Act that keeps the innovation cycle going from academic researcher to company to product sort of breaks down. I would So I think that there's very practical problems in those two sectors. On the other hand, in the electronics and software industry, one has almost the opposite argument, that nuisance suits abound, and the pace of product development is so fast, and the patenting process is so slow that when patents issue, they're usually the product may already be obsolete. And I've heard the general counsel for an electronics company talk about simply stopping any patenting activity by the company and just try to litigate away any suits which are considered nuisance suits to help the company go forward. So it's kind of an annoying cost of doing business. So you have these two very diametrically opposed views about the patent system, and unfortunately in the patent reform debates that have taken place in Congress for the last few years, you kind of have these two poles talking past each other for stronger patents or weaker patents, while the Supreme Court has been making it harder to get patents and weakening the strength of injunctions and limiting the damages that can be obtained. And we've seen that the increase in international protection has reached its limits in India and elsewhere. So it feels like the pendulum swinging somewhat wildly with patent protection is really not getting us to a useful result in the sense of the balance that I talk about. So my view on this is that what we really should be looking towards is something like a Federal Reserve Board of intellectual property that's going to look at the public interest as a whole and try and balance these various strongly held and very important views by different participants. But again, each of them is looking at the trees, not the forest. And the forest is the larger social importance of innovation and the role of intellectual property in driving that forward. And I fear that lobbyists for partisans trying to persuade staffers on the Hill who are really uninformed about most of these issues is not succeeding in finding practical resolutions to these problems.
We're talking with Michael Gollan, author of the book Driving Innovation, here on Hearsay Culture on KZSU-FM Stanford. For those of you that listen to the show regularly, and anyone that listens to KZSU regularly, you know that KZSU is a non-profit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford University that requires donations from listeners like you to continue its broad and diverse programming. And that, incidentally, does include those of you listening by podcast, because KZSU is the home base and will remain the home base of Hearsay Culture for as long as KZSU will have me and I'm doing the show. For those of you that are interested in making a donation to KZSU, you have a couple of options. You can email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Again, that's underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Or alternatively, you can go to our website at kzsu.stanford.edu and click on Donate to KZSU to make that donation. And I'll add an additional note, which is there are a lot of wonderful people working at KZSU to keep KZSU on the air. And they're doing this job behind the scenes. And I think of a number of people that work on this show, and I'll mention them by name here, but certainly Mark Lawrence, the chief engineer, as well as the DJ Chizzy, who mans the board, and various other people that have been manning the board to get the show on the air. So your donations to KZSU go directly to helping keep not only KZSU on the air, but as well as Hearsay Culture. And I thank my friends at KZSU that man the board engineering there at Stanford. So we're back with Michael Gollan. And Michael, let's talk about this human dimension as we transition into the substance of your book. Most of your book, after you do what I think is a very good overview of IP law, focuses on this issue. And in the book, you refer to the human dimension of the innovation cycle as the ghost in the machine. Who does what, why, and how? So let's talk about that at the top level. And to get into that area, you talk about communities in innovation. What do you mean by those, and how do they interrelate?
Well, I've always found it somewhat challenging to think in intangible ideas. I like to think in terms of people and actions. And so I always try to reduce these very abstract concepts of exclusivity and intangible rights and prior art and so on to people doing things. And what gets lost in a lot of the debate and discussion, analysis, teaching, and work in this field is the fact that we're talking about human creativity. It all begins with the mind and the hands and the work of creative people around the world through history. And so you start with the individual who's involved in the creative process. And to me, again, I spoke of my passion about the field, and to me, that is one of the most exciting parts of humanity, and it's really something I think that we need to nurture to improve our standing and our future. So when you start with that, the question is, okay, so if a Michelangelo were to paint the Sistine Chapel on the roof of a barn and not let anybody see it, what good would that be? Well, he might have had some great enjoyment and pleasure in doing that, but it would have no influence. But when he paints it on a chapel seen by hundreds of thousands or millions of people, it becomes a strong influence to society. And to me, the flow of the idea from the originator or a small group of originators out to the increasingly larger groups of people and eventually out into society and out until it either in an unfortunate situation is lost, becoming a lost knowledge, or more desirably becomes part of accepted wisdom, that to me is really a hugely important process. So you start with the creative individuals, and they work in all kinds of situations. And I've had the good fortune over the 20-odd years I've been practicing to work with creative individuals, artists and scientists who've come up with ideas by themselves or with small groups of people who may have organized themselves into small companies. I've worked with bigger companies and divisions of multinational corporations. And as I said, I've worked with research institutions in Africa where the researchers have to confront coming down with malaria or civil war and various other kinds of problems. But in all cases, these are people driven to create. And so in the book, I talk about the range of innovation communities from individuals and small groups, people like Gordon Gould, who was an inventor of the laser, Robert Kearns, who patented intermittent windshield wiper circuits and is now the subject of a major motion picture on his quest to be compensated for that, for all those of us who use windshield wipers that go on and off depending on the rain. And, you know, you look at people like Walt Disney, who built not just a company, but an industry around his creative ideas, starting with the Little Mouse, and Bill Gates, who started writing software, and Steve Jobs, who are individuals who have built innovation communities around them. You look at the range of concerns that small businesses have and large businesses have, and I've, as I say, had the pleasure of working with both. The small companies need to figure out how to protect their rights on a shoestring in a focused technology, a particular molecule or assay they might have, or a particular product, and they typically might employ what I call the burning stick strategy, where they try to get an intellectual property right in each of the categories. So they may get a patent on their initial invention, a mm-hmm. strong trademark, and confidentiality agreements to hold their rights together. And I call it the burning stick because it's like the little guy sitting in the jungle worried mm-hmm. about the wild animals who are going to come to eat him, and you light a fire, and when the animals come along, you shake one of these sticks at them, and it can actually scare them away for a little while.
Uh-huh.
And but then you've got the nonprofit institutions and onward to other communities. And so when you start, when you look at these different types of communities, you can actually extend that analysis, the exclusivity and access and the flow of rights from the individual to society in this innovation cycle, all the way from the individual up to the Silicon Valley community, to the national level, and to international consortia and open innovation communities like Wikipedia. So I think it's a very powerful place to start the analysis.
The issues that come up, and I guess I'll ask you the question this way. When you focus your book on focusing on the importance of leadership, and as you look at your experience counseling clients, if there's one major failure or misconception that you think businesses generally and nonprofits, as you mentioned, so both for-profit and nonprofit institutions make with regard to managing people in the innovative process, what would it be?
Well, I think that's easy, actually, and the answer is strategy. I think that's an often used but misunderstood term. And by strategy, I mean having a clear understanding of the objectives that this group, this community, if you will, a company or a division or a university or whatever the innovation community is trying to achieve. So if you first understand the goals that are in mind, the next thing, and that's really that really comes from desire and drive and will. The next thing is much more objective, which is to look at what the resources are that are available in the organization, in that group of people, both the creative assets that are available and the money and other things. And then the next thing is to look objectively around at the competitive environment and understand who's doing what out there, what the prior art is, what are the competitors doing, what are the alternatives. And then based on the goals, the internal resources, and the competitive environment, to come up with a simple long-term plan for managing intellectual property that's consistent with the resources, the competition, and the goals. And to me, that is just common sense, and that's the way I and many of my colleagues approach any client problem, and the way really just a sound way to approach any problem, from business to politics to many parts of life. But I was quite amazed at a meeting this May of the Licensing Executive Society when presenting this strategic approach. Now, mind you, these are all professionals involved with intellectual property licensing. Mm-hmm. And as I laid out the process of becoming strategic, many people were quite surprised at that, and it was news to many people. And so I think by that measure alone, I'd say that's probably the most common mistake that people in this field make, is not planning. And I can understand why, because this is a very complicated and very detail-oriented world, and it's very easy to get sort of swept away with how do we do this particular process. But I think it's so important to step back and say, what are we trying to accomplish first? Because a lot of times it's most important to decide what to do. And when you decide what you're trying to do, you can then make. I think most of the success is at the strategic level rather than just in how you implement the plan.
As a former litigator and also someone that teaches civil procedure, I'm keenly aware of the issues that litigators go through, and of course, as I mentioned to my students, and certainly in my own experience, when the litigator is on the phone with the client, it's usually the last person the client wants to talk to. Litigation is viewed generally as a nuisance, even by those that are bringing actions to collect funds. It's a drain on resources. It's the last thing that most people want to deal with. And litigators have to face the fact that their clients often feel that way. When you look at this from a litigator's perspective, and by this I mean when you look again at these issues of strategy and management of IP, what do you find are the issues or areas of law that in your experience tend to be the most litigated as a result of the failure that you identified?
Well, I guess the flip answer is litigation itself is often, as you said, a result of a lack of strategic planning.
Right.
Sometimes litigation is a logical and appropriate and strategic thing to do, but oftentimes it is the result of a lot of mistakes. The analogy we learn in the field is that litigation is to negotiation and good management, like war is to diplomacy. So, I think that the way I look at it is, if you come up with a good strategic plan, and this applies in the creative arts and in technology as well, you can minimize the chance of litigation, and where appropriate, use litigation as a strategic tool. And in putting together the parts of the book, there's one part that's on the basic literacy that we talked about. There's one part on becoming strategic. How do you come up with a strategic plan? And the third part of the book is how do you implement the plan? And in implementing the plan, I think it's very important to look through what I've digested in the book is decision trees or flowcharts.
Right.
And again, coming back to this dichotomy between wanting to access other people's innovations and wanting to exclude them from your own. So there are a lot of the complaints that one hears about the intellectual property system, both in the U.S. and overseas, and complaints about access to AIDS medicines and so forth, is really a lack of expertise and cleverness in gaining access to the innovation. And so I have figure 13.3 in the book for anybody who actually wants to look at that. You go through a process of trying to find weaknesses in the intellectual property right, figure out how long it's going to last before it expires, trying to figure out the scope and whether there's a place one can practice in the IP-free zone. Are there alternatives? Can you do something else instead of practicing the invention? And if you can, then of course you go do that instead. Or is there some kind of a bargaining chip, like a defect that can be exploited to invalidate a patent or a trademark? There's some kind of fair use or government right, compulsory license that would allow, for example, in the case of the AIDS medicines, the Brazilian government and others have asserted government rights. So, and then there is one end result of this decision tree, which leads to litigation and a win or loss in court. But there's many other avenues, including simply purchasing or delaying or bargaining to get access to the invention. And then on the other side, to enforce rights, there is a process likewise of triage to figure out if there's a claim to be made. And if one has structured the intellectual property management plan well, then many problems simply won't occur. I describe what's called the six P's of intellectual property management. If you have good personnel practices with good agreements and training for the employees, if you have good contracts with the people providing materials and information to the company and with customers, partnering agreements, and a good plan for policing proactively, these kinds of things can be implemented without a lot of cost and without a huge degree of sophistication, but if done early and consistently, they can really keep litigation to, again, I would say a strategic level where it's necessary to test the principle of law or to deal with a failure of negotiation or something like that.
The author is Michael Gollan. The book is Driving Innovation. Michael, we have about 10 minutes left, and I do want to discuss with you open innovation. Professor Hank Chesbro from Berkeley has been on the show in the past, and others have been on the show discussing not just open source, but the idea of sharing knowledge and sharing information as a means of driving innovation in companies. What's your view on open innovation? And have you had clients that have used it successfully?
Absolutely. I think it's one of the most refreshing innovations and intellectual property approaches, if you will. And I think it's a fallacy to look at open innovation as the opposite of intellectual property protection. To the contrary, open access, open source are very sophisticated and clever intellectual property management plans. So you look at the original approach of open source, this is actually a very careful use of the copyright to create a licensing situation where the user, instead of paying money, pays with a promise to make any changes public downstream. Now, that has led to just a wonderful blossoming of different types of approaches in open science and the wiki type of movement and throughout the world. Now, there's a cost also in the sense of course, the music industry and the film industry are subject to a lot of concerns because of illegal downloads, which are sort of outside of the intellectual property system. And I think open access and open innovation and the Chesbro model goes far beyond that and becomes sort of a management strategy as well as an intellectual property strategy. So the idea is, and this fits back to what I was saying about innovation communities. So a community is a self-defined group of people who get together for a particular purpose, whether social or economic or religious or political or what have you. And in an open innovation community, the idea is that the traditional walls around a corporate community, if you will, are made a little more porous. And so ideas pass through more openly than they do otherwise. But in my experience, having dealt with clients who share quite openly, intellectual property is crucial to that as well. So a company is much more open to sharing ideas if they have underlying patent rights that they can choose to share. You know, you use the analogy of sharing or giving or holding back. If you analogize to a society that gives more versus a society that tends to be more oriented towards property ownership like the U.S., the principle of giving means that there's still some property right. It's the giver's choice to give. It's not the receiver's choice to take something. And so the open innovation and open community is really a kind of a mutual expression of individual choice of the people involved to share their ideas. And so I think I'll leave it at that for the moment, but it's a huge area, and I do work with a lot of nonprofit organizations, including the Gates Foundation, which is funding huge amounts of work in public-private partnerships and universities who are really originators of open innovation. It's nothing new in that sense. Universities, I think there are 40 universities that are 500 or more years old, outliving many of the countries in which they're founded. So this is, I think, an exciting development and goes to my point about innovation and the intellectual property systems supporting it change rapidly over time, especially these days.
Closely aligned to open innovation, at least from the perspective of how one goes about building a business, would be building a business around concepts like fair use. And this is the time in the show where I inevitably tell my guests that I'm going to ask an unfair question because we have about 5 minutes left, and invariably the question requires more time. So I'm going to try to tailor this question narrowly for the time we have left. literally coming across the news today is the settlement, the announced settlement between Google and the authors regarding Google Book Search. And I'm certainly not asking you to comment on what apparently is a 140-plus page settlement document that was announced today. So I want to ask the question more broadly. When I teach intellectual property law to my students, I make the general point that building a business around fair use can be a dangerous proposition. But we see, and again, I mean, this is a document document that came down today, so I've had limited opportunity to look at it, and I imagine no one has taken a close look at it yet, outside of the council and parties to the agreement. But I guess I'll ask your reaction. I mean, we see fair use as a business model growing, and Google perhaps is the and YouTube, which is now of course part of Google, perhaps the greatest example of this, at least in technology. What's your reaction to that? I mean, in 2008, can one build a business around fair use as a doctrine?
Well, there's sort of fair use as a smaller principle in the copyright arena, and Google, of course, is the 800-pound gorilla, and they've managed to really be visionary in their deployment of intellectual property, not just management strategies, but also essentially reforming the law and driving test cases forward with their might. And they're really in the pyramid from non-strategic to visionary strategic. They're really at one of the companies at the pinnacle. But in a larger sense, I think that fair use, if you will, is again nothing new. The U.S., the United States, as a young country, did not award copyright to work from foreigners, so they could import works from England and elsewhere and copy them here. And it was only later that you had reciprocity, and that's happening still in other parts of the world. In Argentina, there's some very sophisticated biotechnology companies, a client of ours, which has cloned cows and is making cows that produce biologic drugs in their milk, which are under patent in the U.S., but not in Argentina. And there's, you know, a part of the world where there is, if you will, fair use. I think there always has been and will be a place for operating outside of intellectual property. Of course, it is risky, and that goes back to my point about becoming strategic and coming up with a plan. If your goal is to provide access to works, and you can find a strategy to do that. Google took a risk and pursued that, and I think that ultimately there is this huge problem of orphan books. A great majority of books that have ever been published are still under copyright, but they're not available for people to access. And so in the innovation cycle I speak about, it's lost knowledge, and so Google is really on the side of expanding access to knowledge. And if people talk about the increasing scope of proprietary rights and stronger patents and stronger copyright and so on, a thing to keep in mind is that the information available to a person living in 2008 is so much greater than it was in 2007 or 2000 or 1900 that although there are stronger intellectual property rights than there used to be, there's much more accessible domain than there ever was. And so, yes, I think there are plenty of business opportunities to be made in that accessible domain.
The author is Michael Gollan, the book Driving Innovation. Michael, for those people that want to learn more about your work and about your book, where can they go?
Well, of course, www.venable.com. I have a bio there, there are some publications in the area that are linked. I'd be happy to hear from any of your listeners at my email, mgollan@venable.com. And let me also make a plug for Public Interest Intellectual Property Advisors, which is PIPA, PIIPA.org, which is a matchmaking organization intended to have developing country organizations who need help with intellectual property matters get help from volunteer IP attorneys in the U.S. and elsewhere in the world. And so that leads into some very interesting kind of global issues about intellectual property as well.
Michael, I thank you for joining me today on Hearsay Culture and for benefiting my listeners with your discussion. And certainly I invite you back on the show to continue because, again, we've touched the tip of the iceberg and this is a fast-moving area. So thank you for joining me today on Hearsay Culture.
It's a great pleasure, Dave. I appreciate it, and I do hope to come back sometime.
I look forward to it. There are a number of guests coming up for the remaining part of the year, going through the KZSU schedule, which ends and goes into interim at the beginning of December. But I'm looking forward to speaking to and chatting with Nick Carr regarding his new edition of the book, The Big Switch. Also, Ned Snow of University of Arkansas, School of Law, discussing fair use and copyright issues. Clay Shirky, the author of the book Here Comes Everybody. Morel Hildebrandt, who's written an interesting book called Profiling, or actually edited an interesting book called Profiling the European Citizen, looking at identity cards used in the EU. Mark Bauerlein, author of the book The Dumbest Generation, certainly taking a dimmer view of technology than most of the guests I've had on the show. Andrew Luman and Wendy Seltzer will be on discussing the Tor project, the somewhat controversial project involving the use of anonymity servers for internet communication. Professor Paul Heald from the University of Georgia School of Law will be on as well. In addition, Professor John Palfrey, the co-founder of the Berkman Center for Internet Society at Harvard Law School, which I think now we should say Harvard College, Harvard University. John will be on discussing the book that he's co-authored with Urs Gasser called Born Digital. Jeff Howe of Wired Magazine will be on discussing his book Crowdsourcing. And also Bob Wallace and H.K. Melton. H.K. Melton being someone very well known to anyone that looks at technology issues in the intelligence communities, and they have a new book out called Spy Tech, focusing on the use of technology in intelligence and counterintelligence activities, and both of them having been high-level members of the Central Intelligence Agency. I'm looking forward to having that discussion as well. As always, you can pick up Hearsay Culture in a number of ways. You can go to hearsayculture.com. You can also, of course, listen live on KZSU FM Stanford, either by going to kzsulive.stanford.edu and streaming the show, or if you're in the Bay Area listening at 90.1 FM. The show is on Wednesdays from 5 to 6 p.m. Pacific time. You can also get the show through iTunes through Stanford's Center for Internet Society webpage by going to the podcast page for the center. And lastly, you can pick up the show through the RSS feed at cyberlaw.stanford.edu, which is the webpage for Center for Internet Society. Thank you again for listening to Hearsay Culture today. I hope you enjoyed the discussion. Certainly send me any feedback, comments, suggestions. I always like hearing from listeners at dave@hearsayculture.com. And I look forward to talking to you next week. Have a great day.